From the studios of Radio Sai at Prashanti Nilayam, I am Chandu Vijay and this is Love to Love. And today we have a talk by Sri Suresh Rao Safkur of Radio Sai. Sri Suresh Rao hails from Mumbai and is a chemical engineer by profession. He got his bachelor's from the University of Mumbai and master's from University of Arkansas, USA. He worked at the Department of Atomic Energy, Mumbai as a Class 1 officer and later joined Bhabha Atomic Research Center and worked there for 19 years till his retirement. He is now settled in Prashanti Nilayam serving Bhagwan through Radio Sai from the year 2004. He is also a poet and has published several books on Chinnakathas in poetic form. The topic for this talk is Sai, the Light of Knowledge, and was delivered in the Satsang Hall here in Prashanti Nilayam on the 16th of August 2019. Interspersed and after the talk, we have some beautiful songs by overseas devotees. At 3:30 p.m., we have the live Telugu segment, Sri Satya Sai Divya Sandesha Jari. And with that, over to Sri Suresh Rao.
Sai Ram, the topic we have selected for today is Sai, the Light of Knowledge. When we say light of knowledge, are there two things, light and then knowledge, separate? We are talking here about the light of knowledge, which is the light of lights. The light of light is only one. And when we say knowledge, we mean the knowledge of that one, the one, supreme one. So when we call Sai the light of knowledge, we mean the supreme, the one without a second, see, that is Brahman itself. So light and knowledge are not two separate things. They are the same as the light of lights. When you say light of lights, we are talking about two types of lights. One is the relative light and the other is the absolute light. The light of lights is the absolute light. Whereas the light we get from the sun or the moon or any other source is a relative light. We say what is that because of which the sun gets its power to shine. So we are talking about that light which gives sun the power to shine. So one is a relative light, the other is a absolute light. See the difference? And so this is the source of all, this light is the source of all lights also. That's what another way of saying it. For this, Swami gives a small story which he talks to the boys, the students sitting there, which drives home this point, you know. The sun god had an ardent devotee who every day used to worship him with 108 names of the Surya Deva, see, the sun god. And so the sun god was very pleased with this devotee because he was devoted and sincerely praying and taking the names of the 108 names of the Surya Deva. However, there was one bit of a problem. The sun god said he is using one adjective among the 108 which I am not able to understand. See? And that is called, O enemy of darkness. The sun god is confused. He says, I am a good man. I don't hurt anybody. I am a non-violent person. I don't have any enemies. He is talking about an enemy called darkness. How is it possible? I should go and find out this Mr. Darkness, shake hands with him, make friends with him. So he goes in search of Mr. Darkness. And he asks so many people for guidance and help, you know, to find this person. Now the others realize that there's no way to explain darkness to the sun. So they tell him, why don't you go into the darkest caves, the deepest oceans, etc., etc., and you may find darkness there. So the sun god goes everywhere, Patala, the darkest of the hells, etc., etc. But wherever he goes, the whole thing is illuminated. And he says, there is darkness, there is no darkness. So he comes back finally dissatisfied with the whole thing. He says, there is no such thing as darkness. My devotee is misinformed, is ignorant. So, for the sun god, there is no darkness. Similarly, when we call the light of knowledge, there is no chance of any darkness in that knowledge. He has gone beyond the opposites of light and darkness, good and bad, right and wrong, honor and dishonor, truth and false, etc., the opposites. He has transcended the opposites, and so it is the light, the one without a second. In Jyoti meditation, Swami tells us to do this Jyoti meditation, in which he shows three stages to which the sadhaka has to go, isn't it? He says, first, you sit before the Jyoti and you say, I am in the light. I am in the light. That is the first stage. Second stage is you try to take the light within your heart, you know. And then you say, the light is in me. That is the second stage. But that is not the final. You still have to go further. And ultimately he says, the light and I are one. I am the light. And that is the final stage of Jyoti meditation. I am the light. So there's a difference. These are the three steps in our Vedanta philosophy. The first step, when you say, I am in the light, there is duality. The light is separate, you are separate. So it is Dvaita philosophy. As you proceed further, you come to the light is in me. See? That is the Vishishta Dvaita, or the qualified non-duality. We say the founder of duality is Madhavacharya, founder of qualified non-duality is Ramanujacharya. And finally, when you say, I am the light, or I and the light are one, that is Adi Shankara's philosophy of Advaita. And every person has to go through these three stages of evolution, spiritual evolution, from Dvaita to Vishishta Dvaita to Advaita. That is what Vedanta philosophy talks about. And Swami is telling us the same thing in different words. Now this light of knowledge, which is the law, it's an all-pervading light everywhere at all times and all places. In other words, omnipresent. But why are we not able to see it? If it is everywhere at all times, why are we not able to see? Suppose there is a lighted room and I sit there and close my eyes, I will not be able to see any light. So the fault lies with the individual and not with the light. The darkness of ignorance has covered up our eyes, you know, and put a shutter on it, because of which we are not able to see the light which is all pervading everywhere at all times. And so sadhana, or what we call aspiration for the light, has to be developed by, and that is what we call as sadhana, striving for the light, in other words. Swami has told so many ways of arriving at this, little by little, gradually, through karma yoga, bhakti yoga, jnana yoga, etc., etc. So these are all the methodologies for arriving at the true light. We call this light, we are not able to see it with this fleshy eyes. For that we develop the third eye. Swami says, develop your third eye, the spiritual eye. We symbolically show it here on our forehead. It actually means the eye of spiritual light. So the fleshy eye is not able to see this light, because after all fleshy eye is made up of, is bound by time, space, cause, effect. It's bound by colors, which is all coming in the three gunas. See, the three gunas. Sattvic, Rajasic, Tamasic. In fact, Swami says this fleshy eye has got three colors. You have the dark pupil, black pupil, and then the white eyeball, and then the red rim caused by the blood vessels and the nerves. So the fleshy eye is made up of three colors, white, black and red. And these three colors, Swami says, stand for, white is purity, the sattva guna, red is rajasic, rajo guna, and the third is black, that is tamo guna. So if you are bound by the three gunas, sattvic, rajasic and tamasic, you cannot see that light. You see only the relative light, see? The light, the sunlight, the moonlight, the torchlight, the tube light, etc. Those are the relative lights, see? We can see only the relative lights with the help of this fleshy eye. So that is why Swami says, develop the eye of knowledge or the third eye of spirituality. A sage visiting a town, neighboring town, and there some youth see him and start making fun of him. They say, "Oh sage, where is God? Can you show me God?" You know, and things like that, you know, trying to make fun of him. So the sage says, "You bring a glass of milk for me." So they get a glass of milk for him. He takes that glass of milk, keeps it in front of him and starts staring at it. He stares for quite a long time, and these young people get impatient. They say, "Hey, what is this you are doing? You are just sitting and staring." And the sage says, "You all believe, and I also believe, that there is butter in the milk. So I am trying to see the butter." And one of these young people says, "Oh, how can you be so ignorant? You cannot see butter so easily. You have to first warm the milk, feed it with some sourness, allow it to wait for a couple of hours, allow it to solidify, and then you have to churn it, and then at last you will get the butter floating at the top." The sage says, "You have answered my question. There is God in this world, and we want to see God. You have to go through this process, step by step, cultivate love, get rid of bad desires, develop devotion, etc., etc. And those are the steps that will take you to the butter of God realization." So when Krishna steals the butter, it is symbolic of this butter which we talk about, butter of truth. See, Chitta Chora, we call him, stealer of butter. So when we say there is relativity and there is the absolute, how do the Upanishads and how do the scriptures explain this relativity as compared to the absolute? Say, relative truth is bound by time, space, cause and effect. Anything that is bound by time, bound by space, cause and effect falls under the relative truth. It's not the absolute truth. And in this world you don't see anything that is not bound by time, space, cause and effect. In other words, name and form. It's bound by time, bound by space, bound by cause and effect. And that we call it as Maya. See, the term Maya is used in Vedanta to explain this relative truths, see, as compared to the absolute truth. Name, form, the three gunas, time, space, cause, effect, all this come under the ambit of Maya. And when we talk about the light of lights, we are talking about the supreme truth, see, the absolute. So, that which is beyond time, that which is beyond space, that is which is beyond cause and effect is called the absolute truth or the transcendental truth or Brahman. We call it as Brahman and Maya. See, two different things in Vedanta. Brahman and Maya are like two parallel lines, infinitely going on. But for the jnani, one who has realized, the Maya line disappears and there is only the one without a second, and that is Brahman. So when it is bound by creation, preservation and destruction, it is called relative. It is not the absolute. So our ancients, our sages, they always talked about two types of vidya, knowledge. Paravidya and aparavidya. Paravidya is always talking about the transcendental, the absolute knowledge. And aparavidya is the limited, the finite, the relative knowledge, the worldly knowledge. In other words, spiritual science versus materialistic sciences. Paravidya and aparavidya. The Atman, the study of the Atman or knowledge of the Atman is called paravidya. And the knowledge of matter and that which is nature or creation is called aparavidya, a relative knowledge, relative truth. So then the important distinction between creator and creation comes in here. See, the rishis, the great sages, were not satisfied with understanding creation alone. They found there is nothing permanent in this creation. Everything is changing. The child becomes a boy, the boy becomes a man, the man becomes an old man and then he perishes. Is there anything permanent about this? Or you take any other material, we may say the sun and the moon are eternal, while we are temporary, but not so. Is the sun eternal? If you go into the sky and see through that Hubble telescope, which is one of the most powerful telescopes, every day you will see at least two or three suns dying out from the millions in the galaxy. Because the time is over, the age is over. They have survived for billions of years, but then they also have to die. We call it the supernova, the black hole, etc., etc. It's because they are crumbling, isn't it? They are perishing. So even the sun and the moon we cannot say is eternal. So what is eternal in this world, in this universe? And so Shankara calls it illusion, because nothing is permanent or eternal in this world. It is an illusion. It is not the truth. Or rather, it's not the absolute truth. It's only a relative truth. He gives the example of the rope and the snake. You all know about it, I think. So, the rishis were not very happy with study of only the creation, because they found it changing all the time, isn't it? So they said, there must be a creator who is not changing, who is eternal. And if this creation is so beautiful and so wonderful, what we see here, how much more beautiful must be the creator? So why not strive for the creator? Look at their thinking, look at their goals, look at their ideals. The impossible. You may call it the impossible, but they made it possible. Immortality, enlightenment, moksha, all stands for that immortal nature. Mrityorma amritam gamaya. Realizing the deathless state, that which is beyond birth and death, that is fearless, beyond all fears, beyond all worries, beyond all ills. And that was the state that the rishis attained, see? The creator himself. And how do you realize the creator? You cannot know the creator. You can only merge in them. Brahma vid brahmaiva bhavati, it is said in the Upanishad. Knower of Brahman becomes Brahman. It's not anybody who says, oh, I know Brahman. He's only bluffing. Because I know Brahman, there is duality coming in here. And Brahman is one without a second. There is no duality. So when you say, Rishi say, Aham Brahmasmi, the Tattvamasi, they are talking about this Brahman without a second. See? They have merged in that Brahman and realized that oneness, the true oneness, the true goal of oneness. So that is why our Indian sculptures, scriptures have never been out of date. For ages and ages they have survived, and they'll continue to survive for ages to come. No invaders have been able to destroy it. That is the Sanatan Dharma of Bharatiyas. In fact, it is the leader, Baba says, it is the guru of the world, because it talks about the highest absolute, which is universal. They don't say only we can realize it. Shrunvante Vishve, that's what the rishis declared. Listen, all of you, Amritasya Putraha, you are the child of immortality. We have realized that, and we are telling you, you are also that. You are also that child of immortality. Irrespective of which caste you belong, which nationality you belong, which gender you belong, which culture you belong, which nation you belong, you are all inheritors of that immortal nature of man. So universal. And that is why the Vedic knowledge, the Vedic scriptures, the Vedic truths have stood the test of time for all ages. And how this is attained, we have talked about it a little bit. Na karmana na prajaya dhane na tyaga naike amritatva manasuhu. Suhu. Not by progeny or wealth or karmas, but by sacrifice alone is this self realized, or the Atman realized. So the sacrifice is the way to this realization. Not by wealth, not by progeny, not by karmas. This is a statement from the Upanishads. We have seen Swami put it in many ways. He says, In simple terms, he tells us this grand truths, you know. He says, jewels are many, but gold is one. See? Gadgets are many, the electricity is one. And so on and on. Cows are many, but milk is one. Clouds are many, but sky is one. And so on. That oneness, the oneness of this Brahman, the oneness of the truth, is what is insisted upon, impressed upon by Swami to all of us. Spirituality aims at this unique oneness. And it's called one without a second. Because it is not one related to two or three or four. It is absolute one, the absolute truth. So it is called one without a second. The moment you make it one related to two or three, it comes within the domain of Maya. It falls into relative truths. Whereas here we are talking about the absolute truth. The one without a second. Word Maya, Swami has said, made of two words, Ma and Ya. Ma means not and Ya means this. So not this, not this, not this. That is how the rishis arrived at the truth. See, by eliminating that which was temporary, transient and changing. Not this, not this, not this. To ultimately realize the truth. So the Atman, you cannot say what the Atman is, but you can say what the Atman is not. See, you arrive at it by a process of negation. That is one of the Jnana Yogic ways, you know, methods of arriving at the truth. So you see how wonderful is this goal of light of knowledge. Wonderful is the ideal. I mean, we may have to strive for it life after life, but the goal is there for all of us. And especially when an avatar like this comes upon earth, it makes it all the more easier for each of us to strive and attain to that goal. That is how we say God is infinite, you see. If you see the definition of an infinite number, an infinite number is a number greater than any number you can think or imagine. So we call God infinite because He is greater than whatever I can imagine or think about Him. After all, I am imagining with my mind and thinking with my mind and intellect, which falls within the domain of Maya itself. So how can the eye see that because of which it is able to see? How can the ear see that because of which it is able to hear? In other words, it becomes subjective. You go deeper and deeper within. Introversion, introspection, contemplation. This is the path of jnana. To realize that by the process of elimination.
You are listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.
The way to God, love.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We will now continue with a talk by Sri Suresh Rao Savkur. This talk was delivered in the Satsang Hall here in Prashanti Nilayam on the 16th of August 2019. Stay tuned.
That's the way to go.
I got some poem here I have written. It is called, "Your Mukti is Not Your Own," says Sai. And why it is not your own? Mukti is the goal, mukti is the goal. No I and mine, how can it be your own? We say I and mine, ahankara and mamakara, isn't it? So my mukti is a misnomer. For in giving that we receive, in giving and forgiving we are redeemed. Your mukti is not your own, says Sai. My mukti, a misnomer, misinterpretation, fells the individual into pits of desolation. Anybody who says, "Oh, my mukti, my mukti, my mukti," he falls into depression only and desolation. Because there's nothing like I and mine here. Mukti is liberation from all I and mine. So it's paradoxical to think my mukti, my liberation. And I'll tell why it is so. Service before self, love all, serve all. Subjugation of ego alone brings vanity's fall. Your mukti is not your own. Mukti is freedom from the self, attachments, desires, power, pelf. Ego strips, jumps, bumps its concomitants. The I, me and mine, follies of jiva ignorant. Your mukti is not your own, says Sai. Grace descends through divine intervention, not by prescription nor by subscription. One bereft of discrimination or heart pure, seeking sense pleasures, misses mark for sure. Your mukti is not your own, says Sai. Ego drains the soul. Unguarded man forfeits true nature. Plunges deep into morass, its mind immature. Burdened by headload of desires at life's behest. Bound by sense of doership, enjoyership, the rest. Your mukti is not your own, says Sai. Ego strengthens grip on the mind's psyche. Physician, heal thyself is too cliche. The ego's shackles bind man to earth, clips wings, blurs vision, etc., no dearth. Your mukti is not your own, says Sai. My nirvana, my salvation, heaven sent. Man skips true means, misses a worthy end. Right thoughts, purity, surrender alone lands the myrobalan fruit on palm of one's hand. Your mukti is not your own, says Sai. In the statement, "I want mukti," lies the solution of abiding tripti. I, ego, want desire, renounce both. Mukti, the isness, glows and stands forth. Your mukti is not your own, says Sai. Man, know thyself is to plumb soul's depths, the core beyond intellect, mind, senses, breaths. The proper study of mankind is man, says Sai. Know thyself, it is to know real man perfect. Your mukti is not your own, says Sai. Camphor sublimates while burning itself, to leave barely a trace of e, mine and self. Hail mukti, hail redemption. Hail freedom, hail perfection. Your mukti is not your own, says Sai. This gives an idea about what we mean when we say mukti and my mukti. Coming to our what we are talking about, we see symbolic of knowledge, we have a deity for everything here in Hinduism. Goddess Saraswati is the symbol for knowledge, no? Goddess of learning, we say goddess of knowledge. And Lakshmi is called the goddess of wealth, or goddess of prosperity. In this world, of course, we worship both. But at a certain level, we worship goddess of wealth, no doubt. But after a certain level, it is the goddess of Saraswati, goddess of learning rather, that all sadhakas will pray to, isn't it? So Swami tells one story, how preferring knowledge over wealth, why you should prefer knowledge over wealth. I put it, Swami's Chinnakathas in a poetic form, a little bit. Shankar Bhatta is an advanced spiritual aspirant, practices japa dhyana to a profound extent, has reduced himself to mere bones and skin. He worships Saraswati, goddess of learning, which is for him the key to open doors of mukti, enlightenment, liberation, awareness, bodhi. Goddess of wealth, Lakshmi sees his sad plight. He struck with sympathy and pities his sight, chides Saraswati for denying him basic amenities, wheels herself in his decrepit hut to pour generosities. Miss Lakshmi is upset to see that sadhaka is so poor, and she is upset with goddess Saraswati. She says, why are you not giving him enough prosperity? So she hides herself in his hut so that she can bless him with prosperity. She offers him fame, fortune and affluence, derides Sri Saraswati for her negligence in conferring joy, comfort to her hapless ward. But Bhatta ignores Lakshmi's baits and turns on. He says politely but firmly, Saraswati has me blessed with the gift of knowledge, the most precious wealth. It enlightens me and liberates. I crave not your grace, so kindly move yourself away from my presence. He rejects wealth and prosperity because he has attained to that enlightenment which Saraswati has graced him. See, due to our attachment to sense organs and the body, we go on praising the beauty of the worldly. A nice rose flower makes one feel happy. By evening it fades to make one gloomy. Every object of beauty generates brief happiness. Permanent happiness is got from timelessness. This is gained only with thoughts of the Almighty and the realm of the Atman, which is true felicity. We suffer because now all our attachment is towards worldly things, transient, and all non-attachment towards God, the infinite. This process must reverse for our own benefit. This is what Swami says. We are attached to things which are temporary and transient, and non-attached to things that are permanent. That is God. He said this process has to reverse. Our attachment should be to God and non-attachment to worldly things. And then he says, it is very easy to renounce and implicitly deem everything belongs to Him, the Supreme. There is nothing to call mine, says Sai. Thus do transcend moha and worldly affinities. Jai Sai. When you say everything is God's and not mine, automatically the attachment to the world starts reducing and attachment to God starts increasing. That's one way of trying it. Another method which Swami explains, when we say Brahman, we also mean the Atman, according to Adi Shankara. What Swami calls unconditional love is also the same thing. Why we just said it is a subjective science, see? To understand the Atman is a subjective science. By introspection and introversion and self-analysis and all, we come to that level of understanding of who am I, in other words, of Ramana Maharshi's, who am I? So the Atman, as he said, you cannot know what the Atman is, but you can know what the Atman is not, because it is the eternal subject within. Everything else can be objectified except the Atman, which is the eternal subject. For example, you say, my house. When you say my house, you are saying the house is separate, I am separate. You say my car, car is separate, I am separate. My TV, you see, TV is separate, I am separate. Similarly, when you go within, my body, the moment you say my body, it means body is separate, I am separate. The moment you say my mind, again the mind is separate, I am separate. My intellect, again the intellect is separate, I am separate. My ego, again ego is a temporary thing. See, ego is separate, I am separate. Finally, you will come, everything is eliminated, and what remains is the Atman, we say then. And you are that. Thou art that. Tattvam asi. That is the process of self-introspection, which Swami has told, and which has been talked about in the Upanishads also. Trying to understand your true nature, that is what we are trying to talk about. Your true nature is the truth, the absolute truth, the Atman or Brahman, whatever you may call it. For this, unfortunately, we are always extrovert. We are looking for truth outside. Very rarely we can go within and find the truth. Swami gives a nice story about this human weakness, you know. He says a man wants to go to the on a pilgrimage. He is a rich man, and in the olden days they used to go with a small bag and walk it up, you know, the hard way. On the way, if they have to spend 2-3 days walking, they stay in a choltri or a dharamshala, and next day again they continue to walk. For them it is a very spiritual exercise. So this man, very well-to-do man, but he goes on this pilgrimage. While going on the pilgrimage, he comes across another person who is a thief. And he says, this man looks like a rich man. No, he is wearing a silk dhoti and thing from, you can make out a rich man from a poor man. So he must be having some good amount of money or, you know, jewels or something. I will accompany him and try to fleece him. So he makes friends with this pilgrim. And they both walk together. He says, hey, you are going to Varanasi? Oh, I am also going to Varanasi, Kashi. So let us go. And thus, that way he makes friends and goes. At night they stop in a choltri, see. They are given a room and they have to just spend the night in that choltri. In morning they again start their pilgrimage. So the thief and this man are given, they are staying in one place, one room. And at night they roll their beddings and go to sleep. The thief is planning to rob him at night in the dark. Around midnight or so, when this man is fast asleep, the thief looks around for maybe with a torchlight or some light, looks around for some gold and money that this man may be having. under the bedding or the things like that. He looks and looks and looks in the cupboard everywhere and he finds nothing. So he is disappointed. After several hours of search, he is finding nothing. So he comes and they both fall asleep, and in the morning when they get up, the thief is very, very inquisitive. He wants to know how this man has hidden all the wealth and where he has hidden his wealth, jewels. So he says, "My dear brother, this place is not very safe, you know. People can steal things. Have you kept your jewels safe? Where have you kept them, by the way?" And this man says, "Oh, that was very simple, very easy. I put them all under your pillow." Now the thief had looked everywhere for the jewels, but not under his own pillow. So you see, it's very, very difficult to be introvert, to look within. We always look out for solutions. And we always look out for answers. We don't look for the answers within. So Swami says, the end of wisdom is freedom. End of culture is perfection. And end of knowledge is love. And the end of wisdom is freedom. So all this applies to the light of knowledge. With the light of knowledge, you get freedom, you get love, you get wisdom, you get perfection. What else we want? Total satisfaction, in other words. And then the deathlessness, all fear, free from all fear, free from all anxieties, free from birth and death, free from all sicknesses. I mean, if you come across a jnani, like I happened to meet one long time back, you may say he's free from all diseases, he's free from all sicknesses, he's free from all fears. But here I was, a jnani who was dying of cancer, you know. Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa also died of cancer and all that. So we, in our worldly ways, we say they are suffering. See, you don't see the difference between the jnani and the worldly man here. But Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, the difference between a jnani and a samsari is like between day and night. You see the contrast. Where the jnani is asleep, the samsari is awake. And where the samsari is asleep, the jnani is awake. Now this is in chapter 2, I think. A fantastic statement. We need to think about, contemplate on this. It is true in a way, if you say, it is totally true, of course. When Shankaracharya announced or proclaimed, Brahman Satyam Jagat Mithyam. What was he saying? Brahman is the truth and this world is an illusion, isn't it? That is the jnani statement. Now what will the samsari say? Jagat Satyam Brahman Mithyam. Just the opposite, isn't it? Jagat, this world is very true, because it is the world that gives me all my pleasures, my joys, my happiness, etc., etc. It's very true. How can you say it's an illusion? And Brahman, you cannot see it, you cannot hear it, you cannot smell it, you cannot taste it, you cannot touch it. All imagination. So for the worldly man, Brahman becomes an illusion, and the world of change becomes the truth. And here, what Shankara is telling us, Brahman is the truth and this world of change is an illusion. So we see there is a difference of day and night. Contrast between the samsari and the jnani. So when we see a jnani suffering from cancer or from anything, we say, how is he different from us? He is also suffering. But we must remember that he is suffering at the body level, isn't it? I am the body consciousness, I am the body attachment is not there. So in your world he is suffering, but in his world he is perfectly happy. There is a world of difference between the samsari and the jnani. So this is to be actually realized. We can only infer how the jnani feels. Like the jnani says, as Swami was saying, jewels are many but gold is one. So jnani says, I know the gold very well. Quality, whether it's 24 carat, 23 carat, what not. Quality of the gold, I am an expert. But if you ask me which are the jewels made from this gold, I don't know. So many jewels can be made by so many people from gold, isn't it? For him, that is not him. The many is not the important thing. The one is the important thing. So getting at the gold, getting at the one, the supreme oneness, is the goal. So wisdom, which is called wisdom, end of wisdom is freedom. Death kills, but wisdom kills death, Swami has said. Conquer the conqueror, death is the conqueror, but the jnani is the conqueror of the conqueror. See how beautiful it is. Mrityurma amritam gamayam, he has realized this. From death lead me to immortality. And he has gained the state beyond birth and death. You may say Adi Shankara, right from, he was a Bal Brahmachari and a Bal Sannyasi. He took sannyas at a very young age. See, Brahmacharya, you go to Grahastha Ashram to Vanaprastha Ashram to Sannyasa. Four stages, you know, the Hindu believes in these four levels. But there are some spiritual genius who can jump from Brahmacharya stage direct into sannyas. Bala Sannyasi, at the age of 9, he was a Bala Sannyasi. And he took the begging bowl as a monk. Where is the wealth, goddess of wealth? And he has taken to the goddess of Saraswati direct, isn't it? So we see here once, I'll put it in a Swami's Chinnakatha here. There lived an old woman most needy, pitifully destitute, deprived in penury. Once Adi Shankara stands before her hovel for alms with his empty begging bowl. When she hears the call of the Acharya, Bhavati Bhikshan Dehi, she despairs, regrets her inability to serve the anchorite, herself being bereft of basic necessities. She clasps her hands, racks her brains, anxious still to offer some food grains. Searching, she unearths a lone myrobalan. Myrobalan is that amla, you know, that sour fruit. Last one of a handful she garners. She offers the myrobalan fruit, drops it into begging bowl of the erudite pandit. Subdued, she shudders to cast her looks at the bright gaze of the itinerant monk. It wrings her heart that lifelong poverty makes her inapt for a little charity. To one so deserving at a moment so propitious, feels unfit to earn merit by service felicitous. I mean, she is very unhappy that she is not able to give even a piece of food to the sannyasi standing before her, the bright looking sannyasi. And she feels very bad. Shankara is moved by her humility and contrition. Shankara observes her bhakti and her compassion. Standing there, he chants a Vedic invocation. See? In praise of the great goddess of opulence, at once there is a shower of gold myrobalance. The old woman is blessed with a bounty which places her far above her penury. She has gifted selflessly the one fruit saved with love and piety, though starving and fed. Hasn't the Lord Himself in the Gita assured that a devout offering with a mind pure, be it even a lake, flower, a fruit or water, suffices to merit Lord's grace in full measure? Jai Sai Ram.
shine down on me.